Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're back! Welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who has discovered a new wall-based mission in life. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much! Thank you. Should have killed me last year. I'm back. Welcome to Series 14, Episode 1. And we're going to hit episode 200 during this series of Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was hanging around with Kel from Keenan and Kel the other day. Things are going all right for him. Keenan's on Saturday Live. He's doing right. But Kel, he calls it Rehearsal. So I don't know if that's going to catch on. And this series is sponsored. We've sold out to the man in return for some beer that they forgot to deliver this week. But that is not representative of the fine service they provide. Beer 52, who did do a few of the podcasts last time, are sponsoring the whole series, have given us a bit of money to... That's nice, isn't it? And some beer. I believe when I see it. And you can get some free beer too if you go to beer52.com/Rahulastapa. That's right. Then you can get 8 craft beers for just $2.95 package and posting. So that is... I like to do things where you get something back, kids. That's what... I'm getting nothing out of this. It's all for you. And also, don't forget, my new book, Emergency Questions, is out on October the 4th, 2018. If you're watching this in the future, it is available. There's 1,001 emergency questions there. Please buy it. And then they might let me go on the telly. I just want to go on the telly. If it sells really well, they might let me go on the telly. Yes. You don't get anything out of it. It's just me. So anyway, I've been living in the countryside for a year now. I'm living in Hertfordshire, and we're just sort of getting used to it now. And before I moved to the countryside, I had this prejudiced idea that everyone who lived there would just be obsessed with bins and dog shit. But now I've lived there for a year, I have realised that those things are very important. So I'm very obsessed.
And what I'm annoyed about people who don't pick up their dog shit. I've got a dog, and wherever the dog does a shit, I pick it up with a black bag. I'm not sick. And I put it in the bin. And lots of people don't bother that. The people who really annoy me in the countryside and the village where I live, and you know who you are if you're listening, are the people who pick up their dog shit, put it in a bag, and then hang the bag in a tree. What the fuck is going on? You've done the difficult bit. Or like put it on a wall. Just take it to a bin. What the fuck is wrong with you people? There's someone in this audience is one of those people. And I want to know why you get off on picking it up. And, oh, I'm not going to carry it around as well. I've done my bit. That is worse. At least the dog shit will disappear eventually, you fuckers. Anyway, and I have got a new mission. I've been walking the dog a lot around a really big field. It takes about 25 minutes to walk around the circumference of it, so it's massive. And it sort of started annoying me. There was kind of lots of stones on the path, so I started picking the stones up and throwing them aside. And I decided, and it's a very stony, soily field, and I feel sorry for the farmer. So I've decided in the next however long left I've got, two times a day, when I walk the dog, I'm going to try and move all the stones off that field. I'm just sort of throwing them higgledy-piggledy into the side, just into the long grass and the hedgerows. But I reckon if I do that long enough, a wall will grow. And that's because I feel like, you know, being a comedian, it's not... It's an ephemeral thing. Laughter is just there and it's gone. Sometimes it's not even there. And, but like a wall, that will survive for many generations. And there's a I've been doing it a week. I would say I have moved 2,500 stones so far. I don't think anyone has noticed what I'm doing yet. There's no wall yet and the field looks exactly the same. I'm not sure either whether the farmer wants the field to have loads of... It might be good for growing peas to have loads of stones in the soil. I don't care. I don't care if it inconveniences the farmer. That is my mission now, and I'm going to see that through. And if not, my kids will carry on. But I'm not going to tell anyone what I'm doing. Nobody knows what I'm doing. They just go, why is the field so clean of stones? Who made that wall? And then eventually somehow word will get out. They'll call it the herring wall. That's why I'm... And I've got a new book... mainly because I've lost the one I was using before. It must be somewhere in the house. The Wookiee one is gone, but I also had a Darth Vader one, and I've gone to the dark side. I hate Star Wars, so I bought the Darth Vader. I want Luke to be killed. That's why I want. I want his arm to be chopped off. I cheered that bit. That was good because I like Darth Vader. I didn't like the bit where Darth Vader turned out to become good again. I haven't really watched it. Anyway, my first guest of the series, I am so excited about this. Absolutely one of my favourite living authors so far. Let's see if he gets through the night. He's best known as the writer of the essay, I Shit My Pants in the South of France. That's why we're here. Will you please welcome the incredible Jonathan Ames, ladies and gentlemen. Sit down with the microphone there. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to England. Thank you. Transatlantic guest. It's amazing. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for mentioning that essay.
Yes.
I've always considered it sort of my Stairway to Heaven or Free Bird. It's often requested. It's amazing how many people... Probably 95% of this audience, so I can't see anyone. It's sort of like being next to the sun. I've had moments of adult... blinding from this way. But there's so much adult incontinence, really. But we have these... things happen. And so... So I wrote this essay, I Shit My Pants in the South of France, and ever since I've been like a repository... For I didn't mean that pun, but for people's confessions of losing control of their bowels, and so anyway, that's a good opening.
So to speak. Well, I became a fan of yours. Weirdly, Stuart Lee, the comedian, some of you may know, I don't know what's happened to him. He at Christmas, he basically gives away to his friends the review copies of CDs and books he's been given. Mm-hmm. And about in the early 2000s, he gave me two copies of your book, and I just assumed because Stuart Lee had given them to me that they were shit. So I didn't read them. And then I read them, and they were, it was two of your collections of essays, and I think Stuart got them for me because I was writing a blog, and it's mildly confessional. My stand-up's mildly confessional. I think he thought we would that I would you know, empathise. Although your stuff is, certainly your essays are, they're very revelatory, revelatory, and you're very open about. Well, you call yourself the Confessions of a Mildly Perverted Author is the subheading of.
Yeah, well, the first essay collection was called What's Not to Love: The Adventures of a Mildly Perverted Young Writer, which was a real marketing mistake on my part. this was the year 2000. At the time, this book by Dave Eggers had come out in the States called A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. And I thought, well, I need something like that. So I came up with The Adventures of a Mildly Perverted Young Writer. And then, for the next decade, and until now, because now it's 18 years later, a lot of times when I've been written about, perverted Jonathan Ames, or pervert Jonathan Ames, Jonathan Ames, the perverted writer, and it was like...
Self-confessed
pervert. I mean, I had myself to blame for this, you know, but it stuck with me, and I don't think the book didn't sell many copies either, that was the other thing.
Well, if you sold a lot in England, it's because I was basically buying it for everybody. I bought my wife a copy of two of your collections just when we got together, but I'd also done it for several girlfriends before her as well, so... So if you have sold a lot in English, it's because of me. There was a spike in London at that time.
I remember when the essay books came out that sometimes couples, it either brought couples together or put them apart.
Yeah.
So that oftentimes the male would be like, read this, you know, and then if the woman liked it, then...
She was a keeper.
Yeah, they knew they would get along. Or vice versa, if the woman gave it to the man and they would, you know, so if they liked stories of scatology or, you know, crabs, you know, these were the sorts of things that I wrote about. So if people could bond over that, then they were meant to be together.
Well, that's it, and I've got two children, so maybe those two children exist because of you and my wife liking...
In a nice way, not a comedic way necessarily, though comedy can be nice. If I helped in any way for you to have love and to bring children into the world, then that's a good thing, even if it's just 2% of the pie chart.
Yeah, that's true.
But I wonder if you hadn't read the book if you would have gotten married, probably. But your whole destiny would be different.
It pushed me away from the single life, having read about your single life towards... But I think it's sort of weird. We sort of touched on this backstage, but because you were writing those essays, the internet existed, but nothing was going up on the internet. Yeah. So it was sort of, and it was astonishing to see someone writing honestly about their personal lives and the things that you're interested in might not be what everyone else is interested in, but then that's the way the world is. But before the internet, you didn't really know that there was these people around. But because the internet's come out, then. Subsequently, lots of people write quite revelatory blogs, or secret blogs online. So it's sort of the whole landscape's changed, both in terms of stuff surviving for a long time that you wouldn't have expected to survive, and also it wouldn't seem as extraordinary, I think, maybe, that someone was writing so openly about.
Yeah, perhaps. I used to have this column in a newspaper in New York in the late 90s, and it was a free newspaper. It would come out once a week. And the publisher just hired a bunch of nuts to write for them, including myself. And I wasn't paid very well. But again, it was pre-internet, so I would put out these outrageous things every week for people to read on the subway, because that's where most people read this particular newspaper. And then it would be gone. So it wasn't like now, where if you put something on the internet, it could be there forever. And I back then, I didn't necessarily want my parents to read the things I was writing. And so it was... I think it was a freer time in a sense. We don't want to get into the depressing topic of how the internet has destroyed so much, but it was nice to be able to write back then, pre-internet.
Yeah.
I was talking to a friend before coming over here. I'm not really on top of things, including podcasts or anything pop culture. I said I'm the opposite of postmodern. I'm pre-modern. But just thought I'd throw it. It was kind of a good one, sort of. And
this is the main podcast, so okay. That's all you need to know.
Right. And another thing I was telling Richard, when there's a lull for a moment, in case the audience for a moment should have a moment to think or to breathe, I can speak backwards words, like podcast is tisakdop, table is elbat, microphone is inachba orkum, Richard is dropker, stage is egats, god, dog. You know. So I should have, no. But it's the lights that are sun-like or god-like.
Yeah, well, you know, if that had come out around the same time you were writing, you might have just gone into the show business doing that.
Speaking backwards the whole time.
Yeah. Well, it'd be sort of... well, I think all the time would probably be too much, but for 2 minutes.
Yeah. Or do
it's a two-minute act, isn't it?
Yeah, like Andy Kaufman, I could have come out and just spoken backwards, yeah. Lifted, you know, expanded my eyes and dropped my shorts and fall to my knees. I don't know what, but anyway.
Well, it was a really important thing for me to read those... and also, because what's lovely about it is, it's, you know, I think there were things that they are, you know, it's being interested in having sex with transvestites and things like that. Mm. Things that aren't really particularly shocking. Really.
Are you talking about your blog or my
own? Oh. But I'm interested. Yeah. I've been married for 10 years. I'm interested in having sex with anything. But you know, it's not. There's a real sweetness behind all of this scatology and ridiculous manginas and...
Yeah, well, I mean, with everything I try to do, my goal is to amuse, to... I guess it's a justification for being an artist. I thought this early on in my life, but most things fade away. Things that you think are true or maxims or ideals, everything, nothing lasts as our minds change. But one thing I've always held on to for a while is the notion of being a clown. That a clown has his or her place in society to distract, to bring comfort, to perhaps make someone feel less alone. So with my essays, that was the goal, to, you know, to amuse, have people feel less alone. And I never tried to hurt anyone else with the essays. I mostly pointed the finger at me. So anyway, those were the
essays. No, well, again, I think that's what spoke to me about it as well. And my comedy is very much about myself and about how useless I am. And I think that you know, it does give you license to expand and explore interesting things. And we should address this, that you called yourself the Herring Wonder, which obviously I have to take issue with. But this was, you had a boxing career.
Yeah, this was back in my days when I had a column, this mad performance artist. I used to perform myself, and I had once called a phone sex line. The straight line was something like $2.99 a minute. Right. And for some reason, the gay line was 15 cents a minute. And I was like, and I was pretty broke. So, and I don't know why it was so much cheaper. But anyway, so I called the gay line, and I'm a rather fluid person, pun not intended or intended. And I met... it was like an old-fashioned chat line. Like, I don't know, somehow you could click a button and talk to other human beings. Again, all pre-internet, And it felt very modern at the time. There was one guy who wanted to do, what was it called, chicken fights, where someone would get on his shoulders and then fight someone else on the shoulders. And I said, wow, that's so interesting. You're into that. I said, as a child, did you ever have a chicken fight and get an erection against the back of someone's head, thinking there must have been some early Proustian connection? And he said, no, what are you talking about? That's weird. And hung up. Like he wanted no insight into this chicken fight fetish. And and then I met another guy, again aggression oriented, who wanted to box someone in like one of these hotel rooms you get for an hour. And I'd always had a fascination with boxing, the romance of boxing. I had tried boxing a little, so I met this guy in a hotel room to box, and that's when I found out why boxer shorts are called boxer shorts, because he wanted to be naked. I said I didn't feel comfortable with that, but he got naked, but I kept my boxer shorts on. I thought, oh my god, they're boxer shorts. Anyway, so we began boxing in this hotel room, and he was really trying to kick the shit out of me. And but then I managed, you know, I was covering up. I threw a right, hit him, and then he gouged his hip into the dresser. It wasn't a proper ring, and it hurt him so much that he stumbled back onto the bed. He said, let's quit. I'm not into this. Anyway, so I told this story on stage or some version of it, and then this guy challenged me, this acquaintance of mine, to a real boxing match, because he didn't like me in downtown New York talking like I was this big fighter. So he challenges me, but it turns out he had had several Golden Gloves matches and was quite sadistic. But so we had this big fight in 1999 in front of an audience of about 600 people in a converted synagogue, 19th century synagogue. Big audience. We had all this undercard fights. I trained for 3 months. And anyway, when he challenged me over the phone and he sent a cameraman, I didn't know what was going on. I suddenly had this inspiration to call myself the Herring Wonder, because I was living on the Lower East Side and there was a herring shop right near me and I was eating a lot of herring. It's very, you know, it's low on the food chain in the sea, so less mercury, but has all the oils you need. And and so I was...
You don't need to tell me.
Yeah. And so I'm like, I'll be the Herring Wonder, because also Jews, when they first came to the U.S., often had to box like most immigrants. And I saw myself as a reincarnated Lower East Side Jewish boxer. And I said, I'll be the Herring Wonder. And I'll train by eating only herring. And I'll have herring breath in the ring to further repel my opponent. And because I noticed my mother, who's very dear, when she would eat herring, sometimes the breath would be incredible, and I felt this repulsion for her, which I... Anyway, so I had this boxing match, and people waved silver herrings in the audience, and I came into the ring with a jar of herring, and then took a public beating for 4 rounds. Even with all my training, my nose was broken, got a concussion. I can't remember things to this day. And then I later had another fight in 2007, which I won. Another writer challenged me through a publishing house. I thought, oh my God, I forget what, maybe it was like Penguin Books. I'm like, Penguin is challenging me to a... Because I thought, I retired for the sake of my brain, but I came out of retirement to fight this Canadian writer who was larger than me and had once taken steroids, but he was very awkward, and I beat him for 3 rounds, so not in a cruel manner, and it was a more gentlemanly fight. Yeah. So that's how I became the Herring Wonder, and it's kind of stuck ever since. So that's why I'm very pleased to meet you.
Yeah, well, I'm like... It's just my name. It's just my name. I had no choice in it.
Can I say one other thing about herring?
Yeah, please do.
So anyway, first of all, I still like it very much. So sometimes I eat it too much and I get sick of it. But I once, as a journalist, was embedded on a Greenpeace boat in Alaska, in the most beautiful terrain, going up some intracoastal waterway, which I can't remember the name of, and it's a gigantic rainforest. And I was on this boat moored late at night, and stars, and we're right on the edge of the Pacific, and you could hear the whales breaching about, you know, maybe 200 yards away from the boat, and around the edge of the boat, with little lights coming out, I saw flowing fish, silver fish, right? And there was a scientist walking the deck with me late at night, and I said, what are all those fish in the water there, and the light so beautiful? And he goes, well, that's what the whales are eating, you know, just 200 yards away, we can hear them eating. And I said, well, what kind of fish is it? And he goes, herring. I'm like, herring? Oh, my God, no, the whale, the most powerful creature in the world, is feeding on it. I was right to think that it would give me superpowers as a boxer. It was so confirming years later to know that whales were feasting on herring like, you know, Jews in Russia in the 19th century.
Yeah. And ladies, watch out. It's also true. If you feast on me, you get the same powers. Don't tell my wife I said that when she comes on as a guest in a few weeks' time. So it's... I've got my wife coming on as a guest. Oh, she's doing a podcast.
Oh,
it's a really bad idea.
Does she listen to the podcast?
She does listen to this, but like the character of Richard Herring is very different than the real Richard Herring. Mm. As you probably noticed, the sharp difference between me on stage and off stage. Mm. He's very rude about his wife. Whereas I love my wife, but this guy... does things like that where he makes rude allusions
and
to ladies.
Yeah, says things like you'd have sex with anybody and stuff like that.
And it's, you know, I have some sex with my wife. We've got two kids. Occasionally I have sex with my wife.
Well, it's good. Affection in a marriage is important.
Occasionally. Let's do an emergency question. First one of the series. It's coming at random, except if it's very English, I will change it to something else. Oh, look, this is a great emergency question for you, and this has come up. How is anyone with any intelligence not an alcoholic?
Well, there is AA, which just arrests the drinking. Well, if you're intelligent, then you're upset, and because it's the world is falling apart, and we die. I'm just thinking this through. You know, this was an emergency question. And so there's a number of things to be upset about. You die, everyone else you know dies. And then we also seem to be mismanaging everything, so that's also upsetting. So alcohol takes that pain away briefly. But I guess all intelligent people should be alcoholic. Yeah. But there's other things they can do to help them not think. Yeah. The idea is the drugs. Less thinking you do, the better. Yeah. Or just be in the now, you know, because if you're in the now, okay, it's okay. We are alive right now. You don't need to drink. It's amazing to be here right now. But we're so afraid to be alive in the moment that we need lots of distraction, like alcohol. I don't know. This, but I think you can be intelligent and not alcoholic, just for the record. So.
No.
No, all right.
I had a drink last night, but I hadn't had a drink for 2 weeks before that. So, you know, I'm fine, right? That's the kind of thing an alcoholic would say. So, and I felt I couldn't sleep. I had two glasses of wine and was unable to sleep. So that's why I'm behaving oddly. I'll try and do one. I've asked that one already backstage. I'll try and do one that's lighter in tone.
Sorry if that was a negative thing to say about how difficult it is to be alive. But it is difficult to be alive. That's why people are here. They want to laugh. They want to, you know, but it's also beautiful to be alive, and we can learn from the difficulties. I'm sorry if these are maxims.
It was very much the correct answer, I think, to that. And it was the questions.
Well, what about the next book should be the answers to the questions? Or just the answers, and you have to figure out what the question was.
Emergency question, Jeopardy. If you were God, what flavour would you have made ejaculate?
All right. Well, that's a wonderful question.
Because it's like God didn't even consider people were going to eat it, wasn't it? Which is short-sighted of God, at the least.
Yeah, I wonder if he or she thought about that. Well, the thing is, I think if I was a God, I would give people the option, like they could hit a button on the male, like on the hip. And if so, let's say for me, I love the fat of a steak. And so if it tasted like that, it would be great. Yeah. Other people like caramel, you know, some people like almonds. So if I was a god, I would give people many options.
So the penis would be like one of those sort of dispensers you get in pubs that you get the soft drinks out of, that press a different button.
Yeah.
You'd be a better god already than the existing.
It's hard for me to give a single answer to anything because I'm not very definitive about things.
Well, that's the beauty. That's what emergency questions are for, really. They're just to waste time before we die. Hopefully not today.
I almost died last night.
Did you? My goodness. God, let's hear about that.
Well, I was.
I thought I was dying last night. So let's do you first.
Well. I was walking about London, and because of this thing of reading backwards, you know when it says, look left? Well, a lot of them say, look left upside down. And so that's look left for the people walking this way, but I see look left. And I get all confused, and I stepped out into the road, and I thought, oh my God, I could have gotten hit by a bus, but I'd looked to the... And then suddenly a motorcycle came right this way. Because I thought, what if I was suicidal? I could really step in front of a bus here in London very easily. Anyway, but I almost got hit by this motorcyclist. And right as I had the thought, oh, I could die easily. And then suddenly this motorcyclist went right past me. And I think he knew, I think he wanted to upset me. But I thought he was really taking a risk because I could have idiotically taken one more step.
Yeah.
And then it would have been like hitting a deer in the countryside. And then I immediately shrugged it off and went and got something to eat. But, you know, we're walking around all the time like time bombs.
Yeah.
We keep coming back to death, but everything is about death.
It is.
And let's move it on to life.
We're done. Birth. That's fine. I'm obsessed with it too, so that's fine. Let's talk a bit more about you. I mean, you've done, what's interesting is the variety of stuff you've done. I'm quite interested in, because your first novel came out in the late 80s.
Yeah, 1989.
And then you had quite a long period of time between that and the next
one. 9 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know these things somehow. Most things I don't, but...
So as a writer, and as, you know, someone who's experienced those kind of highs and lows, it's interesting to... What were you doing in between? You were carrying on writing. You took some jobs, didn't you? You had different jobs.
Yeah, well, my first book, it was sort of a lucky shot out of the gate, came out in 1989, though it didn't sell a lot of copies or anything. It was called I Pass Like Night, which is a line from The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And I took a comma out, but Coleridge had I Pass, comma, like night. I took the comma out. I've always had bad grammar, so it's I Pass Like Night. And then I really struggled to write a second book for the next one, The Extra Man, which we're talking is out here again in the UK, came out in 98. So struggled to write for a couple of years. What little money I had ran out within a year. So I drove a taxi in New Jersey for 2 years. I got a lot of reading done. Back then, you used to sit in a taxi stand. It wasn't, you know, like Uber now. And you had to wait for people to walk up. Or there was one phone that we all shared, all the drivers, that was on this mounted pole.
Right.
And... So then a friend of mine said, maybe you should go back to school. As long as you're in school, you're not failing. So in my late 20s, I went to graduate school in New York City. And then I met a writer, Richard Price. He gave a little seminar at the school I went to. And he said, you have to find something you're in love with. And I thought, that's what I had been missing. I'd been writing a book just to publish again, just to have that thing, whatever sense of self it gave to me, publish a book. But no, to write something, to make a piece of art, I needed to be in love with my subject or fascinated or obsessed. And so I began to look for something that I was in love with or obsessed with, mm-hmm. and began to find my subjects in New York that led to that second book. And during that time also, during the writing of that book, had many jobs. I worked the door at this nightclub called the Fez Nightclub, which was a great nightclub. The singer Jeff Buckley began playing there. That's where I began to perform. It had just opened up. The Charles Mingus Band was there. I also worked at an environmental magazine calling museums all over the country, asking them to subscribe to the magazine. And I had other jobs I can't remember now, but, you know, sometimes I would try to sell myself. It never worked too well, but I did, actually. I would be so desperate and crazy late at night in strange places, but anyway, things like that. Yeah. Is that too much information?
No, not enough.
I know
enough.
My parents don't listen to a podcast.
They won't listen to this. Yeah. Not enough information. And so The Extra Man, I mean, it feels like a lot of your work is autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
The Extra Man, is that something that that came out of this experience of
yes.
New York and your own? What I like about it is that the narrator of the book, who possibly is you, is sort of obsessed with being like Fitzgerald or the writers of old, but is a sort of little bit pretentious with it, maybe, and it's sort of... You're taking the piss out of yourself, it seems, in a little way, in that.
Yeah, well, I got a good piece of writing advice from... I was very lucky to have an incredible writer as a teacher when I was in college, the writer Joyce Carol Oates. And she gave me a piece of advice, which I think could apply to actors and maybe different art forms. But she said you could take one aspect of yourself and from that aspect create a whole character, almost like taking a little bit of DNA.
Yeah.
So for this particular character, I used to have an obsession with appearing like a young gentleman in the works mostly of British writers like Somerset Maugham or Evelyn Waugh or P.G. Woodhouse. And I used to want to dress as I imagined they dressed. You know, I'd go to thrift stores and buy sport coats and things like that. So this character is like, to sound pretentious as you mentioned, but like Fitzgerald talked about his characters as being like brothers. And I think of my characters as cousins. They share a lot of DNA, but they're not quite me.
Sure.
But there's a lot of elements of myself in here, but distorted. And once you change something, then you sort of change everything. But so this book was born out of my time living in New York in the early 90s. And in fact, there's a passage about Trump in here. The book was recently published in Israel, and they headlined with this passage about Trump, which an eccentric character based in real life who would go to Palm Beach where Trump was just trying to break into society down there. And it said something like, Trump tried to break in again, had a big party, but it invited lots of prostitutes. And so he's out again for another year, too vulgar. So it was very prescient back in 92, what I had written. So I'm assuming this is a pro-Trump audience.
Yeah,
now.
Absolutely.
Is
that the whole of the country loves Trump.
Yeah.
We wish it was over. Well, actually, can't do any worse than anyone's doing over here at the moment. So maybe we would. I like you get these little visions of. So early on in the book, there's the bit about going to the opera, but sort of sneaking into the opera with someone's return ticket, so you get to see the second half of the opera, which sounds like something you probably did. But you get a nice idea of those people waiting for their turn, these sort of New York characters.
I lived with an older eccentric gentleman that became my roommate, and I realized when this writer said, find something you're in love with, this eccentric gentleman, I realized I was kind of in love with him. I had never met a human being like this, and the things that came out of his mouth. And we lived in a tiny little apartment. I had the sliver of a room next to the bathroom, and then there was the kitchen, and there was almost no walls. And then on the other side of the kitchen, there was a big hole in the wall like a window. He slept in a little couch on the other side. Oh, and our favorite show was it was Are You Being Served? We would watch that late at night together drinking wine. And but anyway, this character...
New York, it was the height of sophistication.
Yeah. You know, Mrs. Slocum, my pussy's been out all night in the cold. Oh, we would laugh, you know, thinking we were like, this was Oscar Wilde or something. Anyway, this gentleman, he was an expert at what's called second acting. I don't know if you do it here, but we would go, I saw every Broadway musical with him. And then I would meet young women and I would date them. And I'd say, I'm going to take you to a show, but we're just going to see the second act and the second half. And then they liked the thrill of it. So when people would come out, Broadway shows were easier than the opera, but Broadway, everyone would come out and smoke during halftime or intermission. And then you would sort of blend in with the crowd. They'd let you back in. We would grab programs, roll them up like we'd had them in our hands already. And then when you go in, there might be a few empty seats. And they wouldn't check for tickets during the second half. And so I'd see all the shows the second half. And then with the opera...
You can do that in the first half of my shows. there'll always be empty seats.
And the opera was more elaborate, though. You had to get two tickets, and it was a whole ordeal. But we also snuck into the opera and heard some famous opera and... I can't remember which it was now. Maybe Tosca? Does that sound right? Is that pronouncing
it
right?
Yeah, sounds possible. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a terrible punishment to me to go and see any opera, but that's just me.
But when it's free, it's really good.
That's how it's meant to be.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
And the extra man, I was seeing an interview, you said it was turned down 20, it got 20 rejections.
That was a case where I should have come to London and stepped in front of a motorcycle. I really despaired because I spent 4 years writing the book and then like 20 publishers rejected it. And I thought, then someone told me they'd been studying Zen Buddhism and they said, anything you hold on to will cause you pain. I thought, I'm holding on to this dream of being a writer. I have to let it go. What else can I do in my life? And I didn't really come up with much. I thought I could maybe come, you know, witness elections in Eastern Europe or something as the wall was falling. But anyway, luckily it turned out months after it had been submitted, this one editor who we thought had rejected the book had simply not read it. And like 4 months after, you know, and wouldn't return phone calls, and it seemed like a strange way to say no, but that no was the answer. I even tried calling directly myself because I'd met the editor and she wouldn't speak to me. But then out of the blue, luckily 4 months later, she wanted the book and it came out. So, but yeah, that was a dark time.
I mean, but that's what being a writer is in any field, isn't it? It's coping with that. It's very rare that someone comes out fully formed, or even if they do, that they are discovered as fully formed. You know, there's a lot of rejection in the business.
Yeah, and you need that rejection. And I remember at the time thinking, okay, and as I later got rejected more in life, give me more rejection. Each rejection will make me stronger. Or if I must be good if I'm getting this rejected.
Yes.
That was what I was telling myself.
It is true. Well, it's the true in comedy, I think, as in writers, the best people and the worst people get the same amount of rejections, I think. So you're either very good or very bad. And it's, you know, probably for your own sanity, you have to imagine you're good.
I guess.
But the bad people imagine they're good as well.
Yeah. I don't know.
but is it true, the character says that his dad told him that this is just something that worries me, that if you let the gas in your car tank go under halfway, that dirties the engine? Or is that just an old car?
I don't know if this is true. It's something my father always told me, right. And he was obsessed with not letting a tank go below half a tank. And I'm the complete opposite of my father. I live in Los Angeles now. I'm always on this thing. You are out of fuel. I wait to the last. I procrastinate constantly in life, even with gas. And sometimes I don't know. I guess it's my own way of being James Bond. Will I make it to a gas station in time? It's the same thing with incontinence. Will I make it to the toilet in time? You know, you know,
it's fun to leave it to the last minute. That extra thing. Do you want to do? You was going to read a little bit from the book. Do you want to do? Same. We're talking about the book. Should we do the?
I'll read a brief passage. I hope people don't find it offensive. Or anyway, I hope I can even see it. But yeah, in the cab over, I heard that maybe I should read something. So there was a copy of the book. I grabbed it. It's a brief section. So it's a scene between. The narrator is a young fellow, if you want, you could imagine me, living in New York with an eccentric, politically incorrect, older playwright. They're both penniless, and they live in this very small apartment. and it's in the years around 1992. The next day was New Year's Eve, and it snowed. We stayed in, and the other character's name is Henry. The next day was New Year's Eve, and it snowed. We stayed in all afternoon and watched a series of Danny Kaye films on the Classic Movie Channel, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, Court Jester, and The Inspector General. Henry warmed up some apple juice on the stove and added rum, and we sat on the two couches and got drunk. I said to Henry, "Do you think we drink too much?" "Men face reality, women don't. That's why men need to drink," he said. That sounded like a good maxim, so I enjoyed my drink and the movies. And it turned out that we both loved Danny Kaye. This made me feel happy. I kept an accounting of all our similarities, like money in a bank. After the second Danny Kaye movie, Henry said, "Whatever happened to Danny Kaye? It's strange. He just disappeared, and it was before AIDS." "You mean Danny Kaye was gay?" I asked. "Of course," said Henry with annoyance. "He and Olivier were lovers." "Olivier, too? Why don't you know these things?" asked Henry, exasperated with my innocence. "I'm not an expert like you on the sexuality of 20th century figures," I said, fighting back. "You don't have to be an expert. Olivier was British, and the British are all homosexual because of public school. They never really get over it." "I know, you've said that before. Well, some things need to be reinforced." "I can't imagine Danny Kaye and Laurence Olivier," I said. "Oh, yes," said Henry with assurance. "Opposites. I tried picturing them in bed." "Who played the woman?" I asked, phrasing my question in 19th century terms that I thought would appeal to Henry. "Danny Kaye, I imagine. He could do a lot of accents." "That way, Olivier could have a different woman every night." So, well, that's a little passage from The Extra Man.
It's beautiful writing. I I did read it several years ago, and I've reread the first half of it, and it's just the writing is just very enjoyable. It's very witty and very. It's do buy it and go and buy this book and all the other books. You're going to enjoy them a lot, yeah. I think. And I didn't know this, and as a fan of yours, I was surprised to find this out in my research that they made a film of The Extra Man with Kevin Klein. Yeah, Katie Holmes.
And Paul Dano. Yeah. It's a fine film. Kevin Klein is brilliant in the role. And in an odd life imitating art. So the phrase an extra man in upper class New York society, you have what's known as walkers. I don't know if you have a similar phrase or term here in England, but or an extra man. And walkers would be these older men, usually without very much money, who would escort even older widows to lunches, to Broadway shows, to parties, and they were called walkers, and sometimes they were called an extra man, because at a dinner party, there was less men, because the men die off sooner, and women live longer, so sometimes you needed an extra man at the dinner party to keep things boy, girl, boy, girl. So the man I lived with, he was an extra man, though he also liked to say, I'm more than extra, I'm essential. But But sometimes he would get severe sciatica, psychosomatic probably, and he would lie on our dirty floor of our apartment, but he didn't want one of the other extra men to steal his main older lady, who was this wealthy oil heiress in her 90s, who was missing half her face, either from a shotgun blast or cancer, we didn't know which. And so he, at the last moment, told her, I can't make it, but a young friend of mine will pick you up and take her to the Will Rogers Follies, which we had already snuck into, but I had to act as if I had not seen the second half of it, so she would think like she was treating me. So I picked up this ancient lady, I think a limo came for me, went and got her, went to the thing, you know, got her to her seat, you know, she held on to my arm, and you couldn't really see her face, she had this wig, she was bent over, enormous rings, but very charming, and then afterwards, we went to the Russian tea room, and all these people seemed to know her, and she could only drink with a straw, and I think I had to dab her face with a napkin, and I attended to her as best I could. All these people came. She got too drunk in her mid-90s to sign the thing. I signed it. It was over $1,000 for everyone to have dinner. And then I took her home, ended up having to carry her up to bed. The driver helped me. And then as I put her onto the bed, she said, oh, you dear boy. It was very beautiful in a way. And then years later, God, that would have been 93. We shot the film in 2009. So 16 years later, they were shooting in the Russian tea room, recreating that scene. And I was an extra sitting at a table. It was kind of interesting. So yeah. A small anecdote.
Yeah.
Not a laugh at the end, but, you know.
But it's interesting your work. My favorite Bukowski book was Hollywood, which was about his experience of Barfly.
Yeah.
And the film not turning out and the Hollywood people not being very nice. Do you ever thought of, was the experience enjoyable to be with film people, or was it?
Oh yeah. Well, I've also worked a lot on TV, and being on a set, it's like being in a play or a circus. There's a great camaraderie to being on a set. So being on sets is a lot of fun. And I've done a bit of that. So I was happy to be there. And I am a big Bukowski fan, and I love that scene in Barfly where Mickey Rourke is drunk at the bar and goes, to all my friends, and he lifts a drink. And so for many years when I'd be very drunk, I would lift a drink, to all my friends. Maybe I'll do it later tonight with my one friend who I'll have dinner with. to all my friend. But yeah, it was fun to be on that set, and Kevin Klein was, you know, really a brilliant person, I'm glad I got to know him for a little while.
Cool. And you've written a short ebook that's turned this into this very successful award-winning film as well.
Yeah, I wrote a novella called You Were Never Really Here. I have a wonderful publisher, I'll mention them, here in England, called Pushkin Press. And they published my thriller, and they published The Extra Man, another book of mine, Wake Up, Sir, which is a P.G. Wodehouse homage, which never could get published in England, like an American doing an homage to Wodehouse. I mean, I did have a character named Jeeves, which is a bit bit much, but it was a different Jeeves, and legally. And and the Wodehouse estate is quite, you know. But and then in America, though, there was a Wodehouse Society, and it's not like being Salman Rushdie and getting a fatwa, but they were against me tremendously, all 88 members of the Woodhouse Society in Connecticut. They wrote articles about me. So they attended a reading of mine, and someone sent it to me. It said something like, he has none of Plum's charm. And then I met another member of the Woodhouse Society, and she said, I loved your book. I said, I heard that the Woodhouse Society was against me. And she goes, well, they are, but none of them have actually read the book. I thought, oh, God, well, they... Anyway, what was this question?
What it's about. It was about
you were never really here. Yeah, so I wrote this thriller, and it's available out there, and then it became this wonderful movie done by Lynn Ramsey, who's Scottish, and Joaquin Phoenix is the lead, and it's a really strong, unusual movie, and quite proud of it.
Is it going to come to the UK? So I don't think The Extra Man was released in the UK. I would have seen it if it had been.
Yeah, I don't think The Extra Man came here. You were never really here, not to make you feel bad.
But it's out already.
It was out.
Okay, so I've got two small children. I've not seen anything.
Yeah,
I can barely read, let alone go.
I understand. I don't absorb anything. I sometimes hold my phone late at night, and just like it could give me something. You know what I mean? I think our phones have, you know, wrecked us. So anyway, the film came out here, I think, in April, maybe late March. But it must be available streaming in some way.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Oh, well, I would, you know, probably should have watched it before the interview. But...
But you know so much.
It's and Bored to Death was that writer as detective thing which until you'd written this novella you hadn't really explored as fully as that. It's a lot of the same autobiographical stories, but with this idea of in the nighttime, Jonathan Ames works as a detective on Craigslist.
Yeah, well, the Bored to Death, that began as this short story I wrote because I would write all these essays and people would say, oh, you made that up. That didn't happen to you. I'd be like, no, I really did shit my pants in the south of France. But and then when I would write fiction, sort of like you, you'd be like, well, that's really you, isn't it? And I thought, God, when I write fiction, they say it's true. When I write nonfiction, they say I made it up. So I decided to write a short story in which Jonathan Ames, and I wrote it in the style of my essays, puts an ad on Craigslist and becomes a private detective and gets into trouble. And people really believed it. I wrote it for Esquire. They rejected it. And so I ended up, again, mentioning Dave Eggers. I sent it to him for his magazine, and he responded to me. He goes, did that really happen to you? And I thought, this is great. It's worked perfectly. And so anyway, that short story then became the TV show Bored to Death, in which Jason Schwartzman played Jonathan Ames. And what was interesting, just it's self-referential, but I am being interviewed.
Sorry, you're allowed.
Was that for years, as I mentioned, I had been called perverted writer Jonathan Ames or pervert Jonathan Ames or Jonathan Ames. And then suddenly when people would write about me for the few years of Bored to Death, I'd be like, the real Jonathan Ames. So it was kind of, I'd gone from perverted to now I was real because there was the fake one running around on TV.
Yeah.
So, but that's how that show came.
It's a really good series.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, there was sort of a chance of becoming a movie, maybe, or is that all?
There was a chance. I kind of blew it. I wrote two failed screenplays. Maybe it wasn't meant to be, because a lot of times when you make movies out of TV shows, the beauty of television is that they're a little bit like a novel. You have more time. Films have to compress all the information so quickly, and I didn't do it quite right. And I do want to do a shout out to my other TV show, if that's all right, Blunt Talk, I don't think could be seen in the UK, but starred Patrick Stewart and Adrian Scarborough, who's in the audience somewhere, and Dolly Wells, and was a really lovely show and a lovely time, almost like a dream in my life, this odd 2-year dream in California that we all had.
Yeah, is there any way we can see that in the... Is that just illegally?
I think you have to do it illegally. Yeah. It's so frustrating. Patrick Stewart said, I'm going to get it seen in the UK, and he's not been able to make it happen.
Patrick Stewart, of course, travelled from Yorkshire to Bristol in a coal cart with Brian Blessed. He's come up before.
I didn't hear that. What
you won't know. Do you know who Brian Blessed is? He was in Flash Gordon. He said, Gordon's alive! He's a very notable guest of this series. I just had to do a commentary for that episode, so I've just been rewatching myself sitting here. As he spoke, like, it was for them, Jonathan. I'm sorry. You were in this. You did a Jonathan. You did the What's Not to Love pilot. Did you with you played? Yeah,
I played myself. That was my first foray into television. And about that experience, I like to say, well, I have a better line. I can't come to it. At the time, I said, it's the role I've been waiting for. And then I didn't prepare enough because it didn't go to series.
Yeah.
And then I was in Bored to Death. Yeah. I played a character named Irwin. My father's name is Irwin. And I did full frontal nudity. Yes. No showrunner had ever done that. And the whole episode was about men being insecure about the size of their penises. And so I thought, well, I'm going to get naked. I don't know. It was a very self-destructive choice. And I'm normal, you know, in my resting state, normal to, you know, invisible. And the director, who I thought was a friend, had the air conditioning way up on set. And between the nerves and everything else, I completely retracted like something out of nature. There was a little. I was once drunk on stage at some awards thing, and I said it was like a. It was something like a slot for a coin. That was about all you could see, and you know, like a tumor with a slot. And I was anyway. I did that, and then I thought, you know, I'm never going to act again. HBO wasn't very pleased with me. Yeah, I did that on
stage. The last thing I wrote on TV, 2007, was I was one of the characters in, and I was in a bath that I fell out of, and you saw my bum and stuff. I didn't see my cock. But one of the PAs said, you know, they're watching all on a monitor, and the camera that was on the monitor was just the close up on my genitals, just that filling the screen.
Mm. Yeah.
But she said she found it quite hard to work with me after that. After she just...
Well, this particular scene, which I sort of diagrammed in my mind, I always like circles. Circles in comedy are funny, or at least in my mind they are. It's like the spiral, infinity, life. But anyway, I'm found in bed by Zach Galifianakis, and in his girlfriend's bed, or ex-girlfriend. She's not there, but I happen to be there. And he chases me around the bed, naked. And in the very first take, and he's supposed to fall on the bed, and I go running past, he whipped out, and I think phones were starting to become cameras then, this was like 2010, he took a picture of the first take, said, oh, sorry, you know, and I was like, and then it was his idea, because I asked him for permission, I said, would you mind doing a scene in which I'm naked? And he said, only if I can grab your cock. And he said, I've never done that on camera before, something like that. So anyway... So we did this scene, it would be shot from behind where, like, as he's fallen on the bed, I go racing past, I've grabbed my clothes, and he's just going to reach out and try to grab hold of this character, Irwin, but grabs my penis for a moment, stops me, we look at each other, he lets go, and then I keep running. And believe it or not, HBO made me cut that moment. And you weren't going to see the penis, you wouldn't have seen it anyway. I was in the editing room. I couldn't see my own penis. I'm like, where is it? It was so like...
HBO, who famously allow anything on
more
screen.
More or less,
that's the very insulting.
Yeah, so I got these... the email title was cock grab. So there was like at least 20 or 30 emails saying, please let me have this moment. And they made us cut it. I think it's on the DVD extras, like a leftover from a circumcision. That's horrible. But... and then another thing with Zach, they made us cut when the actress Olympia Dukakis, she was giving him a bath and may have penetrated him, scrubbing him, and they made me cut that also. Anyway, but these are... I don't forget these things. I forget everything else, but when it comes to these bad moments I created, I'm like an elephant.
According to IMDb, you appeared in Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
I didn't know about that, but IMDb has gone to a number of things. There's some actor in the late 80s or 90s who was on the number, because a lot of times being interviewed by people, and they'll be like, "You were on Moonlighting." I'm like, and they're so excited to tell me this. I'm like, "No, I'm not. It's on IMDb. Not everything on the internet, I hate to tell you, is not true." No,
I was hoping it was
true. Sorry.
It seemed unlike you were credited as John Ames, so I kind of think it was probably a different guy. That's what I thought, but I don't believe you. I think it was you. I hope it was you. Yeah, listen, we'll do it. We've got a little bit more time. Let's try another.
Also, I just wanted to remind you, just not to be controlling.
Oh, yes.
I do want to make this sound towards the very end, or we could
talk
again
after. Should we do it at the end? We'll do it. We'll build up.
Whenever you want.
Okay, I'll let you know when it's the end, and you can make your sound.
Okay.
Jonathan makes a sound.
Yeah.
It's good that now we've seeded that. People are very excited. Yeah. This will make the last 10 minutes fly.
But yeah, because I saw you looking at your watch.
Yeah, well, because it's... That's not... It's just so I know what time it is.
No.
Because it's flown by.
No, but look, you're a professional. You've got to be aware of the clock when you're doing an interview like this. So...
I think it's gone well.
But can you even see the time on that iWatch or whatever it's called?
Yeah.
Do you have to shake it? Like, I mean,
it's not great, I have to say. But I expect the new version will be good, so I'll buy that. And
Is that what it's called? iWatch? What are they?
Apple Watch.
Apple Watch.
Yeah. I don't know why. It's an interesting.
iWatch, Apple Watch.
Someone must have got the iWatch thing together. I'm pleased. I haven't really been on stage very much for 3 months, so I'm just glad I've got through this. Yeah. And I didn't sleep last night, I nearly died last night. You didn't ask me what happened.
What happened?
I'd had a late meal, and when I say late, at 8:30, but I went to bed at 9:15.
So 45 minutes. Did you finish eating at 8:30?
I've already finished eating. Okay. And I had 2 glasses of wine and I haven't drunk for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then I just woke up feeling... Do you get that way? I think as you get older, and we're sort of a similar-ish age, you're a bit older than I am.
I'm 54.
I'm a stripling of 51. I'm just 51.
Baby.
Yeah. And... Will my hair go by the time I'm 54?
You've held on to it this long. It's really good. I lost mine early on. It was so upsetting.
No, I woke up and I couldn't sleep. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago I happened to have a kind of existential psychological trauma in the middle of the night where I couldn't sleep. A
couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago. And then last night it was like a digestive trauma, but not in a nasty way.
Mm-hmm.
Just I felt like I couldn't breathe properly and my guts were feeling weird.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know, this could be it.
And
I went down to sleep on the sofa so I was out of the way of everyone. And then I thought, if I die now, they'll just come down in the morning and find me dead on my little daughter will run down. Daddy, daddy, why are you pretending to be asleep?
Was this?
And, you know, it gave me some satisfaction.
Yeah,
she doesn't like me, so
every now and then it is fun to wallow in self-pity
But you know when you wake up, I just hate it. I've been through it so many times. There's that 3-hour period and you go, I know I'm not going to go to sleep for 3 hours. I'm going to feel really weird. And I sort of worry that that's the actual reality, that that kind of confusion you feel at 2 o'clock in the morning when you've just woken up is reality, and everything else you manage to kid yourself that the world isn't that empty and hollow.
I didn't entirely follow that.
Okay.
But I
thought you'd get it because you're a novelist.
I definitely came closer to death with that motorcycle. But I am sorry that you were upset like that, though.
Yeah, thank you. So the question I've got here is, weirdly, what is your... stupid question. What has been your least enjoyable experience of food poisoning? Been your most enjoyable experience of food poisoning?
No, but this is amazing that you should ask that, because when you were talking about this middle of the night existential trauma, I almost thought you had died or something, I did flash to a story in my own mind, which didn't seem appropriate to answer, but that question I can answer.
Okay.
So this was a few years ago. It was actually during Blunt Talk. And I went to some cocktail thing at Sony it was actually trying to sell the TV show internationally. Maybe this is why it didn't sell. And sometimes at these group, large, fancy professional things, that's when I do drink too much. It was an open bar. I went berserk. I kept drinking vodka club sodas. I met Wesley Snipes. I I love his movies, and I've watched Blade 100 times or something, and I got my picture taken with him, and he was so cool. He was like a beam of quiet light. It was really interesting. Anyway, but I must have had like 10 vodka club sodas, and I'd even said to the bartender, these are kind of weak. Could you make mine stronger every time I come up? And he must have put it in triple. I didn't notice. And then there was some kind of mad paella that you could eat. So I ate all this paella with lots of different creatures from the sea in it, and got wildly intoxicated, was driven home. One of those rides where you're going, oh, God, you know, where you want to die. You don't think you're going to die. And, you know, make it home. Called the young lady I was seeing at the time. I said, could you come to my house? I don't know. I was having an existential. She came. And then we lay down. I thought, I hate to vomit more than anything. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to vomit. And I got out of the bed to start running to the bathroom. And I think Adrian knows this story. And I start running. And then the paella comes out of me. And yet I'm still running. And I don't know the physics of it. But the paella was here. I'm running. I then hit the paella. And I slip. And I must have slid, because I am now lying in, like, shrimp paella vodka soup all over my back. You know. But it was so funny, I almost laughed. And then made it to the bathroom, vomited more, passed out on the toilet floor, my body blocking the door. The poor young lady said she was going on the internet. How do you help someone who's dying of alcohol poisoning? She couldn't open the door. And then, like, then I vomited again, and I was like a Roman. I suddenly felt better. And she was in bed, she cleaned up everything. I said, you know, I feel a lot better. I think I'd take a hit of pot. And so she was just like... Anyway, but that was food poisoning, yeah. Alcohol poisoning. But that thing of slipping in the paella was so disgusting. So anyway, I had a good question answer. Or answer ready for that question.
Yeah, that's good. Well, you know, we're on the, we're very.
And I thought of your middle of the night crisis, yeah. And I thought of my middle of the night crisis. So
mine was when I got food poisoning from something when I was on my birthday. And I had diarrhea, and then I realized I had to be sick, and then there was no time, so I had to be sick on my own diarrhea.
Wait a second. What?
Well, I had diarrhea on the toilet, and yeah. so then I was going to be sick straight away, so I had to then be, I didn't even have time to flush.
Oh, so you vomited into your diarrhea.
I vomited onto my diarrhea.
Oh, God.
And then it happened, and then I felt great, and then every hour on the hour, it was literally on the hour, the same thing would happen. I was ready for the diarrhea the second time. I was just throwing up, like, by the end, I just kept on throwing up for, like, a whole day until when there's nothing, just weird stuff coming up.
Well, you know,
your soul starts coming up.
That is, I will think about that around 2 o'clock in the morning, and I will bolt out of bed. You bomb. But, you know, that is almost like a moment in classic literature. In Don Quixote... Sancho Panza.
It did strike me at the time.
Yeah, but you can feel like you're part of a long, you know, something that's happened for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
But Sancho Panza drinks some sort of potion that Don Quixote tells him will heal him of all pain. Don Quixote took it, went into a coma, but Sancho drinks it and had simultaneous diarrhea and vomiting for like 2 weeks out of both ends at the same time, like something out of science fiction. And barely survived those 2 weeks. Don Quixote comes out of the 2 weeks and thinking, oh, it worked perfectly. Didn't realize he'd been asleep for 2 weeks. Right. So a week later, Don Quixote has a terrible injury. He has a bunch of teeth broken. He attacked these goat herds or something. And Sancho, for once, thought, I'm going to stay out of the fray and watch Don Quixote take a beating from a distance. Because normally, Sancho would get in the middle and get it worse. This time he watched, thought, okay, I've learned something. So he goes to tend to Don Quixote, comes down the hill. Don Quixote's had these molars broken. Don Quixote remembered, oh, my potion. So he drinks the potion as Sancho comes down the hill. And then Sancho is like, are you all right, master? And Don Quixote goes, I think I've lost some grinders. Can you take a look? And so he opens up his mouth. Sancho looks in. And right at that moment, the potion hit Don Quixote differently this time. Not a coma, and he vomits right into Sancho's open mouth, his own vomit, which smelled of that potion, which Sancho had remembered to cause diarrhea and vomiting, and so he vomited right into Sancho's mouth, and Sancho then vomited right back into Don Quixote's mouth. So this is great literature.
Why does everyone go on about the fucking windmills in that book? That is the best. Yeah, that's the best bit.
This vomiting diarrhea section is, you know, up there with the opening of, you know, Anna Karenina or something.
Well, that is fantastic. We're going to have to end. We're not going to end without, first of all, say go and buy The Extra Man and check out everything else Jonathan's written, because it's... Well, all apart from the thriller, they're all extremely funny and revealing. Do you regret writing any of those things in hindsight? The world's changed so much. Do you kind of wish you hadn't written some of it down?
Well, I was looking through my old essay collections, thinking maybe I'd put together a best of, and I thought, oh God, why did I write that? So I won't include that in the best of. And I've forgotten most of everything I've written. Yeah. Like, I don't know if you're that way, but... I think we all change so much, you know, so it's not the person who wrote The Extra Man, he is not really around anymore. I mean, sort of in this form. Anyway, I won't get into that. We're almost done.
I quite like going, let's go quite deep with this, and then you could do your sound.
Yeah. We all have regrets. And we all change. I actually go deep. How do we change? But we hopefully change for the better. We always try to learn. We try to become more loving, more compassionate. I try to feel empathy in retrospect for your brief crisis last night. It seems very real. You were upset about something. I think you were probably anxious about performing again after 3 months.
I think I probably was, yeah.
Yeah.
So that worked out okay, isn't it?
We're still doing you've done very well.
I've done, thank you. I've done. Yeah, all right. I got to speak in this one. It's been all right. Yeah.
Should I do the sound?
So
I
don't want that to... sound.
Okay.
What about the sound?
Well, let me just take a sip of water. If you could fill the air for a moment.
I can. By The Extra Man. Yeah. Pushkin Press.
Okay. So,
emergency questions. Sphere Publishing.
Eat herring. It's good for you, but you can't change the flavor, even if you're a god. All right. So this is a sound that my friends and I would make on the playground when being attacked by more normal children. And it's known as the hairy call because it was all about going hairy. And the original sound was made by this friend of mine, the child of a chiropractor. And we were learning how to read. He was very chubby, and he was a piano prodigy. And for some reason, out of the blue, we were learning how to read through headphones. He took the headphones off, and he went... like that. This little purr came out of him, struck me in the third eye. Anyway... The sound got louder and louder. We would communicate with that sound as a basis, like emotions, like... like that is how we would talk. And we called this going hairy, and we were hairyators. And the very loud sound, the clarion call of when we were being attacked by more normal children, was known as the hairy call. So I'll do a hairy call now. I'll do three of them to send everyone off into the night, or into the second half of the show.
Yeah.
The second half of the show. So here are three hairy calls. I'll do the best I can.
The podcast with me, Rich Chang, and my guest Jonathan Ames. The music, as ever, is by the popular beat combo Pest. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre, everyone at Go Faster Strike, everyone at the British Comedy Guide. Thanks for all your assistance. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. This week's executive producer, who is much more important than Ben Walker and does a lot more than Ben Walker, of just paying money on the Kickstarter, is Andy Sandel. Andy Sandel. That's nice, isn't it? That's all right. Andy Sandel. This is a Go Faster Stripe Fuzz and Sky Potato production.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage of the French Open begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. gofasterstripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.